the lower you go, the more little molecules are floating around. You know, you go up to space, and it's not a pure vacuum going around Earth. You don't really get to an almost pure vacuum until you get to real deep space. It's actually molecules. I think there's something like one atom per every four centimeters floating around in deep space beyond our the solar system. So there's a lot more than that floating around Earth. The closer you go to, the more crowded it is. So these things tend to deorbit. It takes, I think, 3 years. If you did not boost the space station up, the space station, that's a big thing. If you didn't touch anything for 3 years, the thing would come down. You'd see burning up in the atmosphere somewhere around Earth. So every now and then, either a progress mission goes up there and flies its rockets and pushes it up. Does have fuel on board, does have its own rockets to move it if they had to. But every time the shuttle goes up, they raise it.
Repeater, time out.
Paul said that Hubble is not as big of a problem. It's at a much higher altitude, and therefore its rate of decay is much, much slower. And as you go further out from the Earth's surface, the density of the air gets lower and lower, but never really gets to zero. There's some number of molecules of Earth's atmosphere touching the moon right now. A very, very small number, but it's there. And the whole area of high vacuum, hard vacuum, high vacuum science, and how you measure it, that's another great big science area. Ed Gallander, having trouble thinking of his call letters right now. He and I were having a discussion on that. I guess it was last Thursday. I think we've answered all of the questions of people who signed in. That's one question. Second of all, does anybody have any questions on what they've heard from all of the above so far? Give me your call letters. K2RIW and the TechNet.
I got a comment.
There's the Ed I'm talking about. Go ahead. Ain't it terrible that I forget your call letters? And my question is going to be, how do you measure 10 to the minus 7 torr? You got it, Ed.
Well, I just want to know what's lurking in the background. Pulse WB2EAV. And I personally, at this point in time, have no idea, but I could find out and report back to you.
My real question was, if you were a scientist and didn't have access to the internet where you can look it up, and you were going to design something that can measure very low amounts of air pressure, very high vacuums, how would you do it? And one of the techniques they use that I'm aware of is amazingly simple. It's essentially just a hot wire. Call it a thermistor if you like, but those molecules that are floating around are going to strike your wire periodically and give it a small amount of cooling. And you measure that amount of cooling and interpret that. I've got a vacuum gauge that goes down to, I think it's 10 microns. And I believe my dual stage vacuum pump can go there. Okay, I think we've gone through all of our questions and comments tonight, in which case maybe it's time to either ask, are there any further questions, or then we'll go over to the mailbag. One last question, or one last time. Does anyone have a question they want to ask? K2RIW.
Question actually, traffic for Eric Dick.
Go ahead. Thank you. Go ahead with traffic.
Okay, Eric, you're out there, Eric. What is the Echolink node number? Not the IROP, but the Echolink node number for LIMARC.
I don't remember the precise number, but go through the list, and you'll find one for N2STU. That's Nancy 2, Sierra Tango, Uniform, L.
STU. All right. Now, it's just a little bit easy if you knew the number. Because I'm coming in on RF. I wanted to come into echoing. All right. N2STU slash L. All right. If not, I'll see you. If not, if you can figure it out, or let me know. I'll pump into you on the radio. Thank you, Dick.
What's your guess, Eric, as to how long the transmitter was feeding a capacitively coupled piece of cable? Do you think it was in that state for a day, a week, or a month, so to speak? KE2EJ, KE2RIW?
I think I first noticed it on Tuesday, and then some other people made some noise about it.
Yeah, I did see the power output jumping up and down with rather big numbers. So I know that there were a lot of decibels of different thermal heating or whatever is making that that capacitive gap make and break contact. And had somebody leaned on that particular piece of cable? Is that what happened?
No, a particular piece of cable comes out of the amplifier and goes into a circulator. The circulator was rather heavy, and the circulator wasn't quite mounted properly. And unfortunately, the hunk of cable was got crimp connectors on it, so it didn't get crimped very well.
Are you happy with crimp connectors? My whole philosophy on those is that, yes, they're fast, but when it comes to a very high performance requirement, like around a duplexer, or in an outdoor environment, and where the repeater is mounted, I think it gets a little bit of weather, you know, temperature changes in the wintertime, whatever. I'm not convinced that crimp connectors are justified in some locations. You might have an opinion on that one. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, first of all, those things don't apply to where the repeater is. It's in a controlled environment, it's air conditioned, and a constant temperature. Well, let me tell you that it depends upon what we're talking about. I agree with you in terms of I don't like crimp connectors outside where it's going to be dealt with weather. Rather, true solder is a good thing. You know, we've got this additional material adhering to dissimilar metals and, you know, holding it together. But I will tell you that, especially for like digital video and stuff like that, if I had a solder those 20 or 30,000 BNCs, boy, I'd have a heck of a time. But a properly made crimp connector, properly made, gives you excellent results and long life of service. So there's places for it, and it's definitely faster, without a doubt. But when it comes to like 9913 or something like that, you actually wind up working with two dissimilar metals, depending upon how well you clip it together and how many edges are squishing the cable. And you're doing kind of high power RF. I don't like
them. I'm WB2EAV.
EAV recognized. Yeah, particularly around repeaters where you're looking for 130 dB of isolation. I'm not convinced it's the right way to go. Mr. Gellander, you got it.
Just want to say that a good crimp tool is very expensive, but it's worth its weight in gold. If you try to chintz out and go for some like $5 crimp tool, you're absolutely right. You're going to be disappointed. But they make real crimp tools for a couple of $100. I've never been let down by one of those.
I still have to follow W02N with comments. Bernie recognized you still have to follow a good procedure, though, for proper preparation of the cable. Have you used crimp connectors, and you're happy with them, Bernie? W02N, go ahead.
Well, for years I swore by soldering every connection, but I don't know, maybe 5 years ago I worked with Ford Motor Company, and they, I don't know if they had a patent on it, but they had the butt connector, and we were using them in cars to do wiring in cars, which is exposed, you know, not directly to water, but indirectly, it could get hit with it, and we were using it like on 18, 12 gauge, the wiring in a car, where we would use waterproof plug connector. And with a good crimper, you can actually crimp the wire, slice it, crimp it, tug on it, it's not moving. And then the real trick is that we heat them. With a little, we had these little pocket mini torches, we heat the plug connector, it actually melts, and a little like wax comes out and seals it. And it really makes a waterproof connection where you can, I guess, drop it right into the water. It would just be like the insulation. And we were doing harnesses with it. We would cut the harnesses and butt connecting the whole harness, and we'd stagger. They want the butt connected staggered, especially in like map fences on the car and all, where you don't want any kind of inductance between the wiring. So we staggered a butt connector. But we'd splice whole harnesses and put pigtails and stuff. All done with heat and butt connectors, and you can finally wrap the harness with conduit or tape. WO2N. And Ford accepted that. WO2N.
Eric, do you want to go to comments?
I do wonder, Barry, and I know there's a couple of people who comment, I do wonder what's the maximum length of time that anyone's ever put those connectors under service. And second of all, five times you've used the word button connector. It sounds like you're saying Baker Uniform Tango Tango. You have to spell out the word that you put in front of the word connector. Is it button connector? Over to you, Bernie.
Yeah, I would say it's Tango Tango. Connectors, we call them butt connectors. Came in all sizes and colors, depending on the gauge of the wire. And the great thing, like I said, Dick, they work fabulous. Once you butt connected it, heat would put the wire in there, and you'd watch it and watch till it started to ooze out the side, and you'd take the heat away. And that thing was sealed. It was like hermetically sealed. Worked great. I loved them. I fell in love with them. I had all different colors. Do any color wire. I love doing that. And staggering was the thing when you had sensors that were multi-wired. You have to stagger the connections. That's the way they wanted them. Yep. So they had a regular splicing routine, and if it was good enough for Ford Motor Company, it was good enough for me. WO2N.
Name comes from the fact that the two wires butt up against each other. And I believe butt connectors are for one wire at a time.
Now, I think Bernie is describing a multi-connector, multi-pin connector. And once again, Bernie, to your knowledge, what is the longest length of time that the connector you're talking about has been put into service? Over to you, Bernie.
I would say I go back, let's see. I had 4 years. I've been using them at least 5 years before I retired. I would say 9 years. I haven't seen any fail or corrosion problems with them. I have not seen any fail. So as far as I know, they've been holding up. I haven't seen any failure because of a button. I've seen factory splices fail, just cold splices fail in the wire harness underneath the flooring and stuff. But the button connectors we did in the field, it's done properly. I have not seen them fail.
And Ed was asking the question, what is the number of leads? He thought it was only two wires coming together, tip to tip. I think you're talking about a multi-pin connector that then becomes a plug-in to the edge of a printed circuit board. Is that approximately correct, Bernie? Go ahead.
I'm talking single wire, stranded wire. Single stranded wire. I'm not talking about double piggybacking butt connectors, different sizes into one connector or a multi-size connector. They were single wires, and the butt connectors matched the gauge of the wire. And when it was in a multi-wire, in a harness configuration, we always stagger the connection at least a couple of inches apart. You cut them, and they were running parallel in the harness. Not to get any interference. Mostly on electronic control computer sensors for the electronics in the car. WO2.
And my last question on this one, Bernie, is I'm guessing that a modern-day instrument panel on an automobile is the equivalent of a printed circuit board, and you have to make quite a few contacts to it. How is that done? Is there a pigtail of a bunch of wires coming off the printed circuit board where they're soldered down, and then you're doing these butt connectors downrange from the printed circuit board? How do you make the multiple contacts to the printed circuit board of the instrument panel? In the past automobiles that I've owned, older automobiles, I've had a number of intermittent problems on instrument panels that to me were quite troublesome. WO2N, K2RIW.
WO2N, K2RIW.
Yes.
They have plugs with 26, could be 26 wires. If they had, you could have two or three harnesses coming up to the back of the instrument panel. Instrument panel, printed circuit, and with resistors sometimes on the circuit. We got the old type, not the chip resistors, the old type resistors were the last ones that I saw on there. And instead of placing, I went as far as changing, we had some circuits that had the resistors that were bad, like RPM gauge not functioning correctly. It'd lead to the printed circuit board, and then could be resistors on the back of the circuit board. But other than that, it was just actually find like two or three plugs with maybe 24, 25 wires, and the wire pins are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. You actually have to go in there with like a, I tell you, on my alligator clip, I used to put a straight pin to actually go in there and just probe the contact to see if, check the current, the voltage up there. But they were getting smaller and smaller. And it's most of them are the bullet type connectors, like a male and a female. And I often scratch my head and wonder how they, you know, the surface contact is making that. But a lot of them are changing the gold tip. Like on your on a CT sensor, valve position sensor, they would be gold ends on them. So it would have, because they're resistant, they work on voltage, so low voltage, 5 volt, reference voltage, 5 volts, and down on the 12-volt system. So they were doing a lot of gold because they were getting too much fluctuation with using just regular metal, so they went gold tip. And that cured a lot of the racing and RPM run-ups and stuff like that. But behind the dash, just multi-pin connectors and all different color. Every wire is different color, and it's real challenging to troubleshoot that. WO2N.
Okay, there were a couple other people who wanted to make a comment. Who was that?
Thank you.
Glenn, recognize anyone else?
K2KY, I called a couple of stuff.
Yeah, Mel first, go ahead.
Hey, getting back to BNC connectors, there are a number of different versions of it. We use by the pound now. They had a cheapy BNC connector that was called a twist dot, and all it took was strip the wire, strip the end of the cable, and you just twisted the thing on, had like a spring in there, and they did come loose. I've seen a number of times when the camera's outside the enclosure, the cable would actually fall out. Then they had Amphenol, which one we used was a three-piece crimp pipe. It used a special tool, Amphenol tool, and you crimped the center pin separate, and then it went into the sleeve, into the body, and then the ferrule was pushed up and crimped with another tool. In other words, it was a cutting tool, a center pin squeeze thing that squeezed onto the wire, onto the center of the coax, and then the ferrule that held it into the assembly. And with that, I tell you something, that was strong. Boy, oh boy, you couldn't pull that one off for your life, but it really compressed on to the body with a lot of, force with that, a gear-operated tool, a ratchet-operating tool. So it looked like a... it looked like a hexagonal type of jaw, and it really fit into it and really compressed it on. Never had one of them fail, take over.
That hexagonal jaw compression tool used with the three-piece BNC. Would you trust that in an outdoor environment? And if so, how much weatherproofing did you put around that connector?
They all went into enclosures. None of the cameras ever sat out in the weather directly. So everything is inside the enclosure. But these enclosures, you know, are buffeted by wind. Some of them also had azimuth and elevation control motors on them. I never saw one fail. The three-piece Amphenol with the crimping method, never had one fail, Dick. And all the end, we used them literally by the pound. I don't know how many we went through a week, but to give you an idea, my company at one time became the largest user of building wire in New York City, over.
Wow. Okay. You were using a lot of them. And one last question. Was there a fancy tool that would prepare the end of the cable? How would you get all the dimensions for semiconductor, dielectric, braid, outer polyethylene, whatever? How would you get all those dimensions just right? Mel, go ahead.
Well, the cable, the Amphenol cable, was a specified number for the Belden wire that we were using. The stripping tool, we had several different systems. Now, if you were making up, we used to make up a lot of shorter cables for inside, for connecting up in the control room, where you needed maybe 6, 8, 10, 4, 5 different lengths of cable. Now, you're not going to sit there and, you know, make up all those cables at the location. You came there with the cable. You had an idea once the layout, you know, how long cables you're going to need for hooking up the system. So we had in the shop, there was a machine that they came up. You just shoved the end of the coax into it, and it did the whole process, Dick. But in the field, you carried this kit with you. The Amphenol kit came in a nice blue box with a Velcro snap and everything, and it was inside a stripper that stripped the cable, and then the crimper, the crimping system, and it was a very neat way that the Amphenol came up with it, Dick, and I understand had mil specs right on it, over.
It'd be too easy. Very nice. Mr. AZZ, start off with your name first.
It's KB2ADG, Andy.
Oh, you're making a comment on this subject, Andy? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I use all of the above, all the different connectors, and there's a new connector out now for RCA, BNC, and so on. And basically, it's a crimp tool. It's not a crimp tool. It's a compression tool with an O-ring. And you can use BNC and RCA and F-connector. And it just, you strip it, you put it in, and it puts you right in there with an O-ring. So this is good for outdoor. And the high frequencies, it's used for new, you know, it's required for all cable vision so that it doesn't mess up the higher frequencies by crimping the outer conductor and squashing it, changing the value of the wire.
So it sounds like crimping connectors have come a long way. When it comes to serious microwave work, though, where 141 semi-rigid coax cable is used, I'm not yet convinced that a crimp connector has properly done that particular application. I've seen salt spray tests of semi-rigid crimp connectors, and I wasn't pleased with the results. So when it comes to flexible cables, I'm beginning to think a well-done crimp connector can do a good job. But in semi-rigid cables, I'm not yet convinced. Anyone want to challenge that one?
Okay.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, a couple of things. First off, with modern dashboards, there's something called a LIN bus, L-I-N, and CAN bus, C-A-N, that's used in vehicles, especially Ford vehicles these days. They're pretty much in bed with Freescale and their products. And for example, like the speed controls on the steering wheel and the window controls, essentially come down to a single wire which they send data over. LIN stands for Local Interface Bus. CAN is, CAN is actually a differential bus. So it's got two wires, with one being inverted. So that's why the number of wires in the vehicle is becoming less and less and less, and that's why the connectors are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But if you do go to a particular manufacturer's website of a type of connector, there's a specification of how much UV it can take, how long they guarantee that connection to be good for, which is like in the order of 5-10 years for some things and 20 years for another. So there actually are mechanical stress values. For example, in the case of the connector that I was using, or the cable that was causing the problem up to the repeater, you can only put so much weight on it. Copper is soft, and it will change its shape, and it will draw, and it will change with temperature. And that's just a reality of any kind of crimp. Well, let me drop for a second. With the video stuff, I run 1.6 gigabits down these cables. And if that connection isn't perfect, it just doesn't work. Any slight stray capacitance, anything that rounds those square waves off, you're dead. I can show you a nice piece of cable that works beautifully from 0 to 30 megahertz, but you try to put these square waves through it, it can be a 3-inch piece of cable. Because of that connector, it just won't work. That's one aspect of it. Crimp connectors have come a long way if you use the proper tools. For example, stripping coax today, as Mel was telling about the machine, we had a couple of those machines where it's basically a motor that spins a round hunk of metal which has razor blades on it. But to carry itself around and move, there's a company called Paladin that makes these really wonderful strippers, which has the razor blades in precisely the correct position for the type of cable that you're working with. And the depth of each knife is controllable, and you actually cut the polyethylene jacket, it cuts the braid, it cuts the foil, it cuts the foam in the center, and it leaves you with the correct length of center conductor, which in which you slide the center pin and crimp with a proper tool. By the way, many of these tools are cost up, which is $300 or $400, which give the correct amount of pressure that should not deform the center conductor. It gives the correct amount of pressure on the fill. So there is a real science behind it, and that stuff is good for 99% of your situations. Where you have harsh environments, they have special connectors designed for that. And they also have special connectors designed for where there's going to be tensile strength, you know, where there's going to be tension on between the cable and the connector, but it's designed for a specific cable that has certain mechanical properties that will allow it to take tension. So there's a lot of science in what goes on there. And, you know, in a video application where you have the high data rate passing through the cable, there's a company...
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, you timed out for the last 20 seconds, 15 seconds. But I see that crimp connectors have come a long way. And if you're willing to pay for the right tools to do it right, they do exist. Eric, I know you wanted to make a... I mean, Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead. Can I reach the machine on the HT? Right now you sound pretty good.
Okay, very good. I just wanted to give an update to Rich and to you that I copied Rich on an email that basically has the hex number calculated for the new frequency. QSL deck. I sent also two emails. One email has the HTML and one doesn't, so I don't know which one your editor, but if one doesn't open up, the other one will, so it should have all the information in there. KC2QIQ.
One more comment about connector stick.
Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, the tools that they've come up with for amateur radio operators to put a PL259 on correctly over...
That I don't know. A PL259 by a crimp connector, I'm skeptical of that one. And Eric, if you're still there, the crimp connector that put on your very fancy connectors that go up to multiple gigahertz of digital data. Is that crimp connector crimping the outer braid and the semiconductor simultaneously? Over to you, Eric.
You actually, most cases, have to do the semiconductor separately. By the way, the commercial two-way radio industry has a whole series of PL259s and N connectors that are crimpable. So they're really high reliability connectors, and they are designed to be in an adverse environment. Generally, the N connectors, you have to crimp the center pin first, assuming that the cable's been cut properly with the right tool. Everything's exactly precisely the right length. If you use the correct tool to do the crimping, it applies the correct amount of pressure. They guarantee 20, 30 years for that kind of a thing.
So we interesting. Go ahead, Rich.
First of all, thank you, Glenn. I got what you had to say. And Dick and Erica, I'll address it to you, Dick, because you're net control. I've used crimp type PL259s, BMCs. I've used them at lower frequencies and low power, like 100 watts at 2 to 30 megahertz. And I haven't had any trouble with them, but you know, I've been upgrading the equipment here. I have with a service monitor, some other test equipment. Eric just mentioned a kit. I'll ask you, Dick, and you can turn it over to Eric. If I was going to spend, say, $100 or $150 on a crimping tool, what would you recommend for crimping RF connectors, i.e. PL259s, BMCs, Type Ns, and is there a standardization, or let's say if you use an Amphenol tool, is it only good on an Amphenol connector? What would you guys recommend if I called, say, went online to Bowser or one of those companies, spent $150? What would you recommend in connectors and a tool? Do they come in a kit or what? Back to that.
Can answer that, K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Let's talk for amateur radio use. PL259. You got me wrong when I said, Dick, you said I thought I said crimp on 259. They have tools now. Now, you know, when you go ahead to put a PL259 on, you've got to cut the, you take a razor blade or a hand knife, you will cut the outer covering, and then the correct procedure, what they have now, is what you do. They give you a cutter. Now, this cutter strips away first the, Eric said, it has these blades in there, these like razor blades that are adjustable with that Allen key. It just cuts the outer covering, the polyethylene covering. Now, what you do next, now have you stripped off just the top. You now put, they explain to you, you put like a solder coat around the braid, just wet it with solder. Let me let it drop and I'll describe the rest of the procedure. Okay, now, you put the solder coat around the braid. The next thing it does is now it cuts the braid right through the braid, like you would use a, it actually looks like a little tubing cutter like you would, refrigeration people use. That cuts, you know, how they cut the copper tubing with that little cutter, hand cutter. It cuts through the braid right up to the center of the coax. So that strips that away. Now you got a nice square cut there. The next thing goes on, it goes on to the, over this, and you turn this other part into, and what it does actually puts like a thread onto the, back on the polyethylene jacket. It puts like a maybe two threads. So now when you shove it into the connector to the PL259, you give it a turn in, and the goddamn thing before you solder it, it's so strong you can't pull it off, because you're actually digging into now into the outer covering of the RG8U cable. Now you just solder it up, Dick, over.
And once again, this beautiful system you're describing, Mel, is that the Amphenol brand name? Go ahead.
I think a couple others are marketing now. I think I saw it advertised under some other company, QST. I have to take QST out. I think one of these other companies is advertising, but Amphenol was the one that originated it. And this is for when you're doing soldering. Now, they've got a couple of different versions, like I say, you can still go to soldering on, but they got these fancy crimp tools, as Eric was describing now, with the O-ring built into it and everything. And I'll tell you, Dick, you can literally, whatever it's connected to, lift the piece of equipment up by the cable, and you're not going to pull it out of the connector, over.
KC2EMX?
That sounds nice and strong. I did hear Gordon, W2TTT, on the input, but not coming through the machine. So either the signal wasn't strong enough, or there's not enough PL tone. Want to make one quick attempt, Gordon, W2TTT, K2RIW. The PL is 136.5. 136.5. Without the PL, you'll not come through the machine. Go ahead. Roger. Okay, who was the other person just called? I guess it was Eric was one of them. KE2EJ, go ahead.
You know, I just wanted to point out to answer Rich's question that each manufacturer's connectors are different. Each manufacturer has their own special tool. So if you happen to be have a say, King tool, and you have an Amphenol connector, forget it. It's not going to work. $150 is cheap for the proper crimp tools. They run, they start there and they work their way up. What Mel just described is one particular system. There's another system where the actual cutter is like the paladin. It makes all the cuts at the same time. You work it around the cable. Everything comes off nice and clean. I don't remember who the manufacturer is. There's a communications, I think it's Times, what used to be Times Wire. It is Times Wire. They have a connector that looks like a little round tube that you essentially twist onto the end of the particular coax, and it causes different connectors for different kinds of coax. There's this RG8, which they have a different size center conductor than 9913. Of course, all these crimp connectors do not work with a stranded semiconductor. They only work with solid center conductors. So, you know, if you are doing a lot of work and you use a particular manufacturer's stuff, then you buy that manufacturer's stuff and you continue to use it. To kind of mix and match and everything is not a good thing. If you're only going to make one or two or five or ten, start at a damn thing, you save a lot of money. K2RWK,
yeah, let me ask you to run that by again. You're telling me none of the crimp connectors can handle a stranded center conductor. Or are there versions where you solder the center pin, but then crimp the rest? Over to you, Eric.
No, I've never seen anything like that. Although I assume you could, like, for example, with an end connector that's designed to fit on, say, 9913, you could get a standard center conductor that's the same size, it's smaller, that you could solder. There's nothing to say that these crimp pins can't be soldered. The center conductor pins can be soldered, but, you know, if you feel like doing that, then you're welcome to. If you actually look at the construction of the center pins, they all have a little hole in there. So that way, if you do choose to do that, you get some capillary action.
Good sign. Okay, so it's possible. Who's the other person who signed in? Give me your call letters right now.
2TTT.
Okay, you're coming through the machine. And give us enough audio. You got it, W2TTT. Well, all of a sudden my mind's going blank. Gordon, you got it, Gordon.
Dick, yeah, I have to remind myself when I use this particular radio to find the microphone, stuff it in my mouth, and then speak up on top of that. This is the ICOM 2100 I have here. So anyway, I have something totally, kind of a blast from the past kind of thing. I'm at a I'm up at the scout office here in northern New Jersey, and one of the executives there, his father had been a ham, can't even remember his call, but he gives me an old scanner and to use, and it's a nice little scanner, and that was very thoughtful of him. But in the box with the scanner were two tubes, big old glass tube, which I don't have in front of me, and it's fine. It's something common. We've all seen it before, and I can't remember what it was off the top of my head. But tied on a shoestring to the glass tube was another tube. And I cut away the shoestring and started looking at this tube, and I was saying, oh my, it's a Western Electric 445A reflex klystron, I think. And, you know, the dead giveaway is the WR90 flange built into the side of the tube. So, and a most peculiar cooling arrangement. Really, when I compare it to, let's say, IMAC construction techniques for their tubes, this thing looks very, very almost prototype-y. But it's not. I don't think it is anyway. But it's got a serial number that's in the 3,000 range. But I was fascinated to see this thing. And I was wondering, Dick, if you or anybody else had ever played with one of these things in real life. In the old days, yes. In the very early days of 10 gigahertz ham radio, 1960 style. Klystrons and other things that could just barely oscillate up at those frequencies were being used. Later on, people started using gunplexers. Again, free-running oscillators. These are both of those are called the broadband technique. So when you get on 10 gigahertz by a broadband technique, the good news is it's fairly simple, and you can, in many cases, run full duplex. Transmitters on one frequency, receivers on another. They're separated by 150 megacycles, for instance. And so you FM modulate your transmitter. The guy you're talking to is listening to that frequency. He modulates his FM transmitter, and you're listening to that frequency. Your transmitter becomes the local oscillator for your receiver. So it was a full duplex operation broadband. Nowadays, almost 95% or more of all the guys on 10 gigs are using narrowband techniques, which really means single sideband. Mostly solid state. 2 meters is the most frequently used IF frequency. The transverter takes you 144 megs, converts it up to 10.368 gigahertz, and now it's a full simplex system, transmit and receive. The advantage of single sideband is that you get 20 or 30 decibels more sensitivity. The disadvantage is there's more stages to it, it's more elaborate. It's not just a simple FM modulated oscillator. So you've got an interesting piece of history, but only a couple percent of the guys on 10 gigs today would use that technique, Gordon. W2TTT, K2LIW.
Kind of figured as much. I remember doing the gunplexer routine myself years ago. But, I was just thrilled when I saw this thing. I work for AT&T, so it's a little bit of corporate heritage. So, the thing that really got me was the way this tube is assembled. It almost looks like it was done in kit form, if you will, and you can see that this thing had, been done in a shop that maybe was modifying things or something like that. This wasn't clearly, even though it's got a 3000 series serial number, there's a few things about this tube that strike me as being a bit odd, and I think this guy's father had been in Murray Hill 1,000 years ago or in Whippany, actually Whippany probably. 1,000 years ago. So, anyway, it's been a long time since I held a tube with an octal socket, a classic octal socket. I kind of got rid of all that stuff years and years ago, so it was kind of fun. Anyway, I just thought I'd kick it around and just to see if anyone's ever played with one. But, you know, the reflex Klystron with the with the WR90 flange built on the tube, that's one way to couple output. Anyway, back to you, Dick, and thanks for the indulgence. K2RAW. By the way, is there a net next week given Dayton? W2TTT.
Most likely there will be a net next week, even though there is Dayton. And the guys, I think, are at Dayton Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Yeah, there is a Sunday morning Dayton, and the people start coming back. The people who travel through Dayton, most likely some of them will not be back in time for the net. We'll have to try to carry on without them. I think there will be a net, as long as Mel and I are in the mood. Anyone else with any questions or comments before we go over to Mel's mailbag? Give me your call letters right now, and your name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W-H-O-R-Y. Yes, I have another question. Am I allowed two in one net?
Okay. I heard Joe R-Y-Y very distinctly. I heard another signal on the input that is not coming through the output. It could be a missing PEL. Who was that other station?
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John.
Hey, now we're hearing you, John. And you probably heard some of our comments with reference to the rubidium oscillator. Maybe, although you're not using a rubidium oscillator, maybe you've got a comment on that. So that's the previous subject. I'm going to you for now, John. KD2BD, K2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. My only comment is that the calculation that was presented sounds familiar. I recently ordered a DDS synthesized oscillator kit that uses a very similar calculation, 2 to the 32nd power. And the reference oscillator in that case is 30 megahertz, which I think I might change to something a little bit more exotic so that it can get more exact frequencies out of it. But I had some comments on some questions that stumped the group last week, so if my signal is holding up, if you'd like to hear about that, I'll discuss that briefly. K2RW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, your signal's holding up quite well, so go right ahead, John.
Okay, very good. Yeah, there was a question at the end of last week's net that stumped the group, and that had to do with knowing a field strength measurement, calculate the voltage induced into an antenna of a specific length. And I believe the numbers last week were a field strength of 650 microvolts per meter, an antenna that was 2.5 meters long, and the question was, how much voltage is induced into that piece of wire? Well, it's actually pretty simple, and Mel was pretty close to some of the responses that he was giving. We have to make an assumption that wire is short in terms of wavelength, that it is an electrically short E-field probe, and let's say it's a tenth of a wavelength, or shorter than a tenth of a wavelength. If we make those assumptions, then the voltage induced into that wire will be half its physical length times the field strength. So in that example, with 650 microvolts per meter, 2.5 meter long antenna, you do the math, you come up to about 812 microvolts of induced voltage. There are a couple of references to this. The Antenna Engineering Handbook, the third edition, page 4-23 and 4-24 talk about effective length, or effective height of antennas. Also, Krauss's book, Antennas, the second edition, pages 40-42 discuss voltage induced into antennas, knowing the field strength and electrically small antennas and effective height and things of that sort. So those are the references that used to come up with those numbers. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Okay, you are doing the assumption of an electrically short piece of wire as far as wavelength is concerned. If the piece of wire was exactly a half wavelength long, resonant, and properly impedance matched, what would the answer then become, John?
I'd have to open up the books to the pages that I just described. I'm sure it'll be a lot greater. But in working with E-field probes, working with loop antennas, there are a series of equations that can be used to calculate the effective height of those types of antennas. And knowing the effective height and field strength, you simply multiply those two figures together to get the induced voltage. I could break out those books if you really want some numbers. I can give you some equations. I think they're a little difficult to describe in words, though. K2RW from KB2BD.
2KEY with a comment.
No, recognized. With the question that I asked, I've often answered that question. Because in the case of a half-wave length piece of wire, you assume it is a half-wave dipole in free space. The effective capture area of a half-wave dipole is very close to 0.13 lambda squared. So if you assume that the wire was resonant, they didn't tell you what frequency they're operating at. So it's an ambiguity to the question. But if they told you the frequency, if you assume the frequency, and you assume it's a half-wave long, and you know the exact capture area of that antenna, and therefore, and you know the E-field, you know what the watts per square meter are going to be, you know how many square meters of effective the antenna is going to have, therefore, if it's impedance match, you know the exact power. You don't know microvolts, you know the exact power it's going to receive. You can convert that power to dBm if you like. You can then make the assumption that the transmission line is 50 ohms, 70 ohms, 300 ohms, and you can convert that power into a number of microvolts on that transmission line. That's real world. When you make a real electromagnetic interference measurement in an EMI laboratory, they do set up a dipole and make it a resonant dipole to measure the E-field. They do not measure the E-field with a random length of wire that's only a tenth of a wavelength long. That's what I have observed. You might differ on that one, John. KD2BD, K2LIW.
No, I agree. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've run through calculations that did essentially what you're describing. For example, knowing a transmitter power, effective radiated power, and antenna pattern, and location, and the intervening terrain between the transmitter and a particular receiving height, and the height of the antenna, receiving antenna, and its gain and its pattern, figure out, try to calculate what the received signal strength would be, what the field strength would be, with the induced power level into that antenna would be in dBm. I've done all those sorts of calculations. In fact, there'll be a little bit of that mentioned in the July-August issue of QEX. I co-authored an article on a piece of software that I wrote that discusses and studies VHF and UHF propagation, and I've gone through a lot of that mathematics. K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
So the up-and-coming issue of QEX, the July and August issue, has an article authored by you. Is that true? Is that true, John?
Roger, roger. Co-authored by myself and Whiskey 5, Golf, Foxtrot Echo.
Okay, we'll look forward to that. Good to know. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel.
Is Walt Maxwell... I got a whole bunch of stuff on him, but I remember directly he made a statement. He said that, I remember him, he had his big letters, the square of the field strength is directly proportional to the transmitter power. Do you remember that, Dick? Over.
I don't remember Walt saying it, but it makes sense. As you double the transmitter power, the watts per square meter you're going to get at a fixed distance is also going to double. Therefore, when you double the power in watts per square meter, the volts would be square root of 2 greater. You'd have to go 4 times higher in power to double the microvolt per meter, is my belief. So, Mel, go ahead.
Last week, I looked it up. The question was about... How was the question, basically? I remember the answer, but I'm just trying to remember. I'm trying to reconstruct. Oh, yeah. The field strength, I got it here. The field strength at the receiver position is 650 microvolts per meter. If the receiving antenna is 2.5 meters long, the signal voltage induced in the antenna is. So what I did, I don't know. I figured that the signal voltage induced in the antenna would be equal to the field strength multiplied by the antenna length. And that's how I did it. I did 650 times 2.5, which gave me 1625 microvolts, or would be 1.63 millivolts. That's the way I could only think of an answer to that, Dick. Over.
That answer will give you a ballpark. In other words, it's not 10 to 1 too large or 10 to 1 too small. But the answer will be different if that is a resonant half-wave dipole, properly impedance matched, that piece of wire. And I think John came up with a slightly different answer where there's a 2 to 1 factor in there. Is that true, John? KD2BD, K2RIW?
Roger, Roger, K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD. Roger, with the effective height of the antenna, if it's electrically small, is about half its physical length. And the voltage induced into an electrically small antenna is equal to the field strength times the effective height. So in last week's example, 650 microvolts per meter, a 2.5 meter long wire, calculating a voltage induced of about 812 microvolts, KD2BD.
So is it true, then, can I make a general rule of thumb? The word effective height, which is often used on HF antennas, and particularly in an HF or a MF broadcast antenna, a monopole type antenna, the word effective height is often used. And it, as a VHF operator, those words confuse me a little bit. Can I make a general rule of thumb that the effective height is half the length of the wire, or half the length of the antenna? Over to you, John.
You can make that assumption only if the electrical length of the antenna is small in terms of wavelength. For example, 1/10 of one wavelength. And I agree, that's kind of a effective height, effective length, a kind of confusing terms. The first time I ever read that, I thought it had something to do with height above average terrain, but it has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with that. But it's primarily an HF, MF, and lower frequency phenomenon where you're dealing with antennas that are lower or smaller in physical length than the resonant length, and they are not impedance matched, and they are not brought to resonance through inductors and capacitance circuits. K2RW from KD2BA.
Okay, you just said a mouthful. Not impedance matched. If the antenna is not impedance matched, does that mean I'm doing a pure E-field probing as if my measurement equipment had an input impedance of infinity? I'm measuring the pure open circuit microvolts on that piece of 2.5 meter long wire as if it was going into an electrometer, a device that created no loading. And if it creates no loading, then there's no real power flow. You're just measuring pure open circuit voltage. But if you're measuring pure open circuit voltage, you got to measure it with reference to something. Is the something the rest of the universe? If I'm making a non-impedance matched, infinite impedance instrumentation measurement, where is the reference point for that measurement? KD2BD, K2RIW.
I think you have it exactly right, but I'm guessing that it has to be done with respect to ground. If there are no other references, then when we speak about voltages, we have to speak with respect to some kind of a reference or imaginary ground. But true, it's an E-field probe, and you're doing no impedance matching. You're feeding it into a very high impedance voltmeter, essentially, and you're just measuring the voltage. You don't care about the current. You're not going to have any current flowing out of that, or essentially no current flowing out of that that E-field probe. K2RW from KD2BD.
Now, it seems kind of silly to ask that kind of a question on a test where you're teaching a student wireless concepts, microvolts per meter, watts per square meter, power flux density, E-field, H-field, and whatever. To put that kind of a question into a test suggests that it is real. Since, to my knowledge, no one uses instrumentation in that manner, why the hell would you teach that? KD2BD, K2RIW.
Well, maybe if you want to build an active antenna, a short width for use on HF or lower frequencies, and you're curious as to how much voltage you're going to get out of it, or you want to work in reverse, you're able to measure the voltage that's coming out of that